Have you got your bag? Let us walk about here on the platform, said she, a little flurried at the idea of so soon being left alone, and her bravery oozing out rather faster than she liked to acknowledge even to herself. She heard a step following them along the flags. It stopped when they stopped, looking out along the line and hearing the whiz of the coming train. They did not speak. Their hearts were too full. Another moment and the train would be here. A minute more and he would be gone. Margaret almost repented the urgency with which she had entreated him to go to London. It was throwing more chances of detection in his way. If he had sailed for Spain by Liverpool, he might have been off in 2 or 3 hours. Frederick turned round, right facing the lamp, where the gas darted up in vivid anticipation of the train. A man in the dress of a railway porter started forward, a bad-looking man who seemed to have drunk himself into a state of brutality, although his senses were in perfect order. "By your leave, miss," said he, pushing Margaret rudely on one side and seizing Frederick by the collar. "Your name is Hale, I believe." In an instant, how, Margaret did not see, for everything danced before her eyes, but by some sleight of wrestling, Frederick had tripped him up, and he fell from the height of 3 or 4 feet, which the platform was elevated above the space of soft ground by the side of the railroad. There he lay. "Run, run," gasped Margaret. "The train is here. It was Leonard's, was it? Oh, run, I will carry your bag." And she took him by the arm to push him along with all her feeble force. A door was opened in a carriage. He jumped in. And as he leant out to say, "God bless you, Margaret," the train rushed past her, and she was left standing alone. She was so terribly sick and faint that she was thankful to be able to turn into the ladies' waiting room and sit down for an instant. At first she could do nothing but gasp for breath. It was such a hurry, such a sickening alarm, such a near chance. If the train had not been there at the moment, the man would have jumped up again and called for assistance to arrest him. She wondered if the man had got up. She tried to remember if she had seen him move. She wondered if he could have been seriously hurt. She ventured out. The platform was all alight, but still quite deserted. She went to the end and looked over, somewhat fearfully. No one was there. And then she was glad she had made herself go and inspect, for otherwise terrible thoughts would have haunted her dreams. And even as it was, she was so trembling and affrighted that she felt she could not walk home along the road, which did indeed seem lonely and dark, as she gazed down upon it from the blaze of the station. She would wait till the down train passed and take her seat in it. But what if Leonard's recognized her as Frederick's companion? She peered about before venturing into the booking office to take her ticket. There were only some railway officials standing about and talking loud to one another.
"So, Leonard's has been drinking again," said one, seemingly in authority. "He'll need all his boasted influence to keep his place this time."
"Where is he?" asked another, while Margaret, her back towards them, was counting her change with trembling fingers, not daring to turn round until she heard the answer to this question.
"I don't know. He came in not 5 minutes ago, with some long story or other about a fall he'd had, swearing awfully, and wanted to borrow some money from me to go to London by the next up train. He made all sorts of tipsy promises, but I'd something else to do than listen to him. I told him to go about his business, and he went off at the front door."
"He's at the nearest vaults, I'll be bound," said the first speaker. "Your money would have gone there too if you'd been such a fool as to lend it."
"Catch me. I knew better what his London meant. Why, he has never paid me off that 5 shillings.
And so they went on. And now all Margaret's anxiety was for the train to come. She hid herself once more in the ladies' waiting room and fancied every noise was Leonard's step, every loud and boisterous voice was his. But no one came near her until the train drew up, when she was civilly helped into a carriage by a porter, into whose face she durst not look till they were in motion, and then she saw but it was not Leonard's. Chapter 33. Peace.
Sleep on, my love, in thy cold bed, never to be disquieted. My last good night, thou wilt not wake till I thy fate shall overtake.
Dr. King. Home seemed unnaturally quiet after all this terror and noisy commotion. Her father had seen all due preparation made for her refreshment on her return, and then sate down again in his accustomed chair to fall into one of his sad waking dreams. Dixon had got Mary Higgins to scold and direct in the kitchen, and her scolding was not the less energetic because it was delivered in an angry whisper, for, speaking above her breath, she would have thought irreverent as long as there was anyone dead lying in the house. Margaret had resolved not to mention the crowning and closing of fright to her father. There was no use in speaking about it. It had ended well. The only thing to be feared was lest Leonard should in some way borrow money enough to effect his purpose of following Frederick to London, and hunting him out there. But there were immense chances against the success of any such plan, and Margaret determined not to torment herself by thinking of what she could do nothing to prevent. Frederick would be as much on his guard as she could put him, and in a day or two at most he would be safely out of England. "I suppose we shall hear from Mr. Bell tomorrow," said Margaret.
"Yes," replied her father, "I suppose so."
"If he can come, he will be here tomorrow evening, I should think."
"If he cannot come, I shall ask Mr. Thornton to go with me to the funeral. I cannot go alone. I should break down utterly."
"Don't ask Mr. Thornton, Papa. Let me go with you," said Margaret impetuously.
"You? My dear, women do not generally go."
"No, because they can't control themselves. Women of our class don't go because they have no power over their emotions, and yet are ashamed of showing them. Poor women go, and don't care if they are seen overwhelmed with grief. But I promise you, Papa, that if you will let me go, I will be no trouble. Don't have a stranger and leave me out. Dear Papa, if Mr. Bell cannot come, I shall go. I won't urge my wish against your will if he does." Mr. Bell could not come. He had the gout. It was a most affectionate letter, and expressed great and true regret for his inability to attend. He hoped to come and pay them a visit soon, if they would have him. His Milton property required some looking after, and his agent had written to him to say that his presence was absolutely necessary, or else he had avoided coming near Milton as long as he could, and now the only thing that would reconcile him to this necessary visit was the idea that he should see and might possibly be able to comfort his old friend. Margaret had all the difficulty in the world to persuade her father not to invite Mr. Thornton. She had an indescribable repugnance to this step being taken. The night before the funeral came a stately note from Mrs. Thornton to Miss Hale, saying that, at her son's desire, their carriage should attend the funeral, if it would not be disagreeable to the family. Margaret tossed the note to her father. "Oh, don't let us have these forms," said she. "Let us go alone. You and me, Papa. They don't care for us, or else he would have offered to go himself, and not have proposed this sending an empty carriage."
"I thought you were so extremely averse to his going, Margaret," said Mr. Hale in some surprise.
"And so I am. I don't want him to come at all, and I should especially dislike the idea of our asking him. But this seems such a mockery of mourning that I did not expect it from him."
She startled her father by bursting into tears. She had been so subdued in her grief, so thoughtful for others, so gentle and patient in all things, that he could not understand her impatient ways tonight. She seemed agitated and restless, and at all the tenderness which her father in his turn now lavished upon her, she only cried the more. She passed so bad a night that she was ill-prepared for the additional anxiety caused by a letter received from Frederick. Mr. Lennox was out of town. His clerk said that he would return by the following Tuesday at the latest, but he might possibly be at home on Monday. Consequently, after some consideration, Frederick had determined upon remaining in London a day or two longer. He had thought of coming down to Milton again. The temptation had been very strong, but the idea of Mr. Bell, domesticated in his father's house, and the alarm he had received at the last moment at the railway station, had made him resolve to stay in London. Margaret might be assured he would take every precaution against being tracked by Leonard's.
Margaret was thankful that she received this letter while her father was absent in her mother's room. If he had been present, he would have expected her to read it aloud to him, and it would have raised in him a state of nervous alarm which he would have found it impossible to soothe away. There was not merely the fact, which disturbed her excessively, of Frederick's detention in London, but there were allusions to the recognition at the last moment at Milton and the possibility of a pursuit, which made her blood run cold. And how, then, would it have affected her father? Many a time did Margaret repent of having suggested and urged on the plan of consulting Mr. Lennox. At the moment it had seemed as if it would occasion so little delay, add so little to the apparently small chances of detection, and yet everything that had since occurred had tended to make it so undesirable. Margaret battled hard against this regret of hers for what could not now be helped, this self-reproach for having said what had at the time appeared to be wise, but which after events were proving to have been so foolish. But her father was in too depressed a state of mind and body to struggle healthily. He would succumb to all these causes for morbid regret over what could not be recalled. Margaret summoned all her forces to her aid. Her father seemed to have forgotten that they had any reason to expect a letter from Frederick that morning. He was absorbed in one idea, that the last visible token of the presence of his wife was to be carried away from him and hidden from his sight. He trembled pitifully as the undertaker's man was arranging his crepe draperies around him. He looked wistfully at Margaret, and when released, he tottered towards her, murmuring, "Pray for me, Margaret. I have no strength left in me. I cannot pray. I give her up because I must. I try to bear it. Indeed I do. I know it is God's will, but I cannot see why she died. Pray for me, Margaret, that I may have faith to pray. It is a great strait, my child." Margaret sat by him in the coach, almost supporting him in her arms, and repeating all the noble verses of holy comfort, or texts expressive of faithful resignation, that she could remember. Her voice never faltered, and she herself gained strength by doing this. Her father's lips moved after her, repeating the well-known texts as her words suggested them. It was terrible to see the patient struggling effort to obtain the resignation which he had not strength to take into his heart as a part of himself. Margaret's fortitude nearly gave way as Dixon, with a slight motion of her hand, directed her notice to Nicholas Higgins and his daughter, standing a little aloof but deeply attentive to the ceremonial. Nicholas wore his usual fustian clothes, but had a bit of black stuff sewn round his hat, a mark of mourning which he had never shown to his daughter Bessie's memory. But Mr. Hale saw nothing. He went on repeating to himself, mechanically as it were, all the funeral service as it was read by the officiating clergyman. He sighed twice or thrice when all was ended, and then, putting his hand on Margaret's arm, he mutely entreated to be led away, as if he were blind, and she his faithful guide. Dixon sobbed aloud. She covered her face with her handkerchief, and was so absorbed in her own grief that she did not perceive that the crowd, attracted on such occasions, was dispersing, till she was spoken to by someone close at hand. It was Mr. Thornton. He had been present all the time, standing, with bent head, behind a group of people, so that, in fact, no one had recognized him. "I beg your pardon, but can you tell me how Mr. Hale is? And Miss Hale, too. I should like to know how they both are." "Of course, sir. They are much as is to be expected. Master is terribly broken down. Miss Hale bears up better than likely." Mr. Thornton would rather have heard that she was suffering the natural sorrow. In the first place, there was selfishness enough in him to have taken pleasure in the idea that his great love might come in to comfort and console her, much the same kind of strange passionate pleasure which comes stinging through a mother's heart when her drooping infant nestles close to her and is dependent upon her for everything. But this delicious vision of what might have been, in which, in spite of all Margaret's repulse, he would have indulged only a few days ago, was miserably disturbed by the recollection of what he had seen near the outward station.
miserably disturbed. That is not strong enough. He was haunted by the remembrance of the handsome young man with whom she stood in an attitude of such familiar confidence, and the remembrance shot through him like an agony, till it made him clench his hands tight in order to subdue the pain. At that late hour, so far from home, it took a great moral effort to galvanize his trust, erewhile so perfect, in Margaret's pure and exquisite maidenliness, into life. As soon as the effort ceased, his trust dropped down dead and powerless, and all sorts of wild fancies chased each other like dreams through his mind. Here was a little piece of miserable, gnawing confirmation. She bore up better than likely under this grief. She had then some hope to look to, so bright that even in her affectionate nature it could come in to lighten the dark hours of a daughter newly made motherless. Yes, he knew how she would love. He had not loved her without gaining that instinctive knowledge of what capabilities were in her. Her soul would walk in glorious sunlight if any man was worthy, by his power of loving, to win back her love. Even in her mourning she would rest with a peaceful faith upon his sympathy. His sympathy? Whose? That other man's. And that it was another was enough to make Mr. Thornton's pale face grow doubly wan and stern at Dixon's answer. "I suppose I may call," said he coldly. "On Mr. Hale, I mean. He will perhaps admit me after tomorrow or so." He spoke as if the answer were a matter of indifference to him, but it was not so. For all his pain, he longed to see the author of it. Although he hated Margaret at times, when he thought of that gentle, familiar attitude and all the attendant circumstances, he had a restless desire to renew her picture in his mind, a longing for the very atmosphere she breathed. He was in the Charybdis of passion, and must perforce circle and circle ever nearer round the fatal centre. "I dare say, sir, master will see you. He was very sorry to have to deny you the other day, but circumstances was not agreeable just then." For some reason or other, Dixon never named this interview that she had had with Mr. Thornton to Margaret. It might have been mere chance, but so it was that Margaret never heard that he had attended her poor mother's funeral. Chapter 34. False and True. Truth will fail thee never, never. Though thy bark be tempest-driven, though each plank be rent and riven, truth will bear thee on forever. Anon. The bearing up better than likely was a terrible strain upon Margaret. Sometimes she thought she must give way and cry out with pain, as the sudden sharp thought came across her, even during her apparently cheerful conversations with her father, that she had no longer a mother. About Frederick, too, there was great uneasiness. The Sunday Post intervened and interfered with their London letters, and on Tuesday Margaret was surprised and disheartened to find that there was still no letter. She was quite in the dark as to his plans, and her father was miserable at all this uncertainty. It broke in upon his lately acquired habit of sitting still in one easy chair for half a day together. He kept pacing up and down the room, then out of it, and she heard him upon the landing opening and shutting the bedroom doors without any apparent object. She tried to tranquillize him by reading aloud, but it was evident he could not listen for long together. How thankful she was, then, that she had kept to herself the additional cause for anxiety produced by their encounter with Leonard's. She was thankful to hear Mr. Thornton announced his visit would force her father's thoughts into another channel. He came up straight to her father, whose hands he took and wrung without a word, holding them in his for a minute or two, during which time his face, his eyes, his look, told of more sympathy than could be put into words. Then he turned to Margaret. Not better than likely did she look. Her stately beauty was dimmed with much watching and with many tears. The expression on her countenance was of gentle, patient sadness, nay, of positive, present suffering. He had not meant to greet her otherwise than with his late studied coldness of demeanour. But he could not help going up to her, as she stood a little aside,
rendered timid by the uncertainty of his manner of late, and saying the few necessary commonplace words in so tender a voice that her eyes filled with tears, and she turned away to hide her emotion. She took her work and sat down very quiet and silent. Mr. Thornton's heart beat quick and strong, and for the time he utterly forgot the outward lane. He tried to talk to Mr. Hale, and his presence always a certain kind of pleasure to Mr. Hale, as his power and decision made him and his opinions a safe, sure port, was unusually agreeable to her father, as Margaret saw. Presently Dixon came to the door and said, "Miss Hale, you are wanted." Dixon's manner was so flurried that Margaret turned sick at heart. Something had happened to Fred. She had no doubt of that. It was well that her father and Mr. Thornton were so much occupied by their conversation. "What is it, Dixon?" asked Margaret, the moment she had shut the drawing-room door. "Come this way, miss," said Dixon, opening the door of what had been Mrs. Hale's bedchamber, now Margaret's, for her father refused to sleep there again after his wife's death. "It's nothing, miss," said Dixon, choking a little. "Only a police inspector. He wants to see you, miss, but I dare say it's about nothing at all." "Did he name?" asked Margaret, almost inaudibly. "No, miss, he named nothing. He only asked if you lived here, and if he could speak to you. Martha went to the door and let him in. She has shown him into Master's study. I went to him myself to try if that would do, but no, it's you, miss, he wants." Margaret did not speak again till her hand was on the lock of the study door. Here she turned round and said, "Take care Papa does not come down. Mr. Thornton is with him now." The inspector was almost daunted by the haughtiness of her manner as she entered. There was something of indignation expressed in her countenance, but so kept down and controlled that it gave her a superb air of disdain. There was no surprise, no curiosity. She stood awaiting the opening of his business there. Not a question did she ask.
"I beg your pardon, mum, but my duty obliges me to ask you a few plain questions. A man has died at the infirmary, in consequence of a fall, received at Outwood Station, between the hours of 5 and 6 on Thursday evening, the 26th instant. At that time, this fall did not seem of much consequence, but it was rendered fatal, the doctors say, by the presence of some internal complaint and the man's own habit of drinking." The large dark eyes, gazing straight into the inspector's face, dilated a little. Otherwise there was no motion perceptible to his experienced observation. Her lips swelled out into a richer curve than ordinary, owing to the enforced tension of the muscles, but he did not know what was their usual appearance, so as to recognise the unwonted sullen defiance of the firm's sweeping lines. She never blenched or trembled. She fixed him with her eye. Now, as he paused before going on, she said, almost as if she would encourage him in telling his tale, "Well, go on." "It is supposed that an inquest will have to be held. There is some slight evidence to prove that the blow or push or scuffle that caused the fall was provoked by this poor fellow's half-tipsy impertinence to a young lady, walking with the man who pushed the deceased over the edge of the platform. This much was observed by someone on the platform, who, however, thought no more about the matter, as the blow seemed of slight consequence. There is also some reason to identify the lady with yourself, in which case..." "I was not there," said Margaret, still keeping her expressionless eyes fixed on his face with the unconscious look of a sleepwalker. The inspector bowed, but did not speak. The lady standing before him showed no emotion, no fluttering fear, no anxiety, no desire to end the interview. The information he had received was very vague. One of the porters, rushing out to be in readiness for the train, had seen a scuffle at the other end of the platform, between Leonard's and a gentleman accompanied by a lady, but heard no noise. And before the train had got to its full speed after starting, he had been almost knocked down by the headlong run of the enraged half-intoxicated Leonard's, swearing and cursing awfully. He had not thought any more about it, till his evidence was routed out by the inspector, who, on making some farther inquiry at the railroad station,
had heard from the station master that a young lady and gentleman had been there about that hour, the lady remarkably handsome, and said by some grocer's assistant present at the time to be a Miss Hale, living at Crampton, whose family dealt at his shop. There was no certainty that the one lady and gentleman were identical with the other pair, but there was great probability. Leonard's himself had gone, half mad with rage and pain, to the nearest gin palace for comfort, and his tipsy words had not been attended to by the busy waiters there. They, however, remembered his starting up and cursing himself for not having sooner thought of the electric telegraph for some purpose unknown, and they believed that he left with the idea of going there. On his way, overcome by pain or drink, he had lain down in the road where the police had found him and taken him to the infirmary. There he had never recovered sufficient consciousness to give any distinct account of his fall, although once or twice he had had glimmerings of sense sufficient to make the authorities send for the nearest magistrate, in hopes that he might be able to take down the dying man's deposition of the cause of his death. But when the magistrate had come, he was rambling about being at sea, and mixing up names of captains and lieutenants in an indistinct manner with those of his fellow porters at the railway. And his last words were a curse on the Cornish trick, which had, he said, made him £100 poorer than he ought to have been. The inspector ran all this over in his mind, the vagueness of the evidence to prove that Margaret had been at the station, the unflinching, calm denial which she gave to such a supposition. She stood awaiting his next word with a composure that appeared supreme.
"Then, madam, I have your denial that you were the lady accompanying the gentleman who struck the blow, or gave the push, which caused the death of this poor man."
A quick, sharp pain went through Margaret's brain.
"Oh, God, that I knew Frederick was safe!"
A deep observer of human countenances might have seen the momentary agony shoot out of her great gloomy eyes, like the torture of some creature brought to bay. But the inspector, though a very keen, was not a very deep observer. He was a little struck, notwithstanding, by the form of the answer, which sounded like a mechanical repetition of her first reply, not changed and modified in shape so as to meet his last question.
"I was not there," said she slowly and heavily.
And all this time she never closed her eyes or ceased from that glassy, dreamlike stare. His quick suspicions were aroused by this dull echo of her former denial. It was as if she had forced herself to one untruth and had been stunned out of all power of varying it. He put up his book of notes in a very deliberate manner. Then he looked up. She had not moved any more than if she had been some great Egyptian statue.
"I hope you will not think me impertinent when I say that I may have to call on you again. I may have to summon you to appear on the inquest and prove an alibi, if my witnesses," it was but one who had recognized her, "persist in deposing to your presence at the unfortunate event."
He looked at her sharply. She was still perfectly quiet, no change of colour or darker shadow of guilt on her proud face. He thought to have seen her wince. He did not know Margaret Hale. He was a little abashed by her regal composure. It must have been a mistake of identity. He went on. "It is very unlikely, ma'am, but I shall have to do anything of the kind. I hope you will excuse me for doing what is only my duty, although it may appear impertinent." Margaret bowed her head as he went towards the door. Her lips were stiff and dry. She could not speak even the common words of farewell. But suddenly she walked forwards and opened the study door and preceded him to the door of the house, which she threw wide open for his exit. She kept her eyes upon him in the same dull, fixed manner until he was fairly out of the house. She shut the door and went halfway into the study, then turned back as if moved by some passionate impulse and locked the door inside. Then she went into the study, paused, tottered forward, paused again, swayed for an instant where she stood, and fell prone on the floor in a dead swoon.
Chapter 35. Expiation.
"There's naught so finely spun, but it cometh to the sun."
Mr. Thornton sate on and on. He felt that his company gave pleasure to Mr. Hale, and was touched by the half-spoken, wistful entreaty, but he would remain a little longer. The plaintive, "Don't go yet," which his poor friend put forth from time to time. He wondered Margaret did not return, but it was with no view of seeing her that he lingered. For the hour, and in the presence of one who was so thoroughly feeling the nothingness of earth, he was reasonable and self-controlled. He was deeply interested in all her father said. "Of death and of the heavy lull, and of the brain that has grown dull." It was curious how the presence of Mr. Thornton had power over Mr. Hale to make him unlock the secret thoughts which he kept shut up even from Margaret. Whether it was that her sympathy would be so keen and show itself in so lively a manner that he was afraid of the reaction upon himself, or whether it was that to his speculative mind all kinds of doubts presented themselves at such a time, pleading and crying aloud to be resolved into certainties, and that he knew she would have shrunk from the expression of any such doubts. Nay, from him himself, as capable of conceiving them, whatever was the reason he could unburden himself better to Mr. Thornton than to her of all the thoughts and fancies and fears that had been frost-bound in his brain till now. Mr. Thornton said very little, but every sentence he uttered added to Mr. Hale's reliance and regard for him. Was it that he paused in the expression of some remembered agony? Mr. Thornton's two or three words would complete the sentence and show how deeply its meaning was entered into. Was it a doubt, a fear, a wandering uncertainty seeking rest, but finding none? So tear-blinded were its eyes. Mr. Thornton, instead of being shocked, seemed to have passed through that very stage of thought himself, and could suggest where the exact ray of light was to be found, which should make the dark places plain. Man of action as he was, busy in the world's great battle, there was a deeper religion binding him to God in his heart, in spite of his strong willfulness, to all his mistakes, than Mr. Hale had ever dreamed. They never spoke of such things again, as it happened, but this one conversation made them peculiar people to each other, knit them together in a way which no loose, indiscriminate talking about sacred things can ever accomplish. When all are admitted, how can there be a holy of holies? And all this while, Margaret lay as still and white as death on the study floor. She had sunk under her burden. It had been heavy in weight and long carried, and she had been very meek and patient, till all at once her faith had given way, and she had groped in vain for help. There was a pitiful contraction of suffering upon her beautiful brows, although there was no other sign of consciousness remaining. The mouth, a little while ago so sullenly projected in defiance, was relaxed and livid. E parche della sua labia si mova, uno spirito soave e pien d'amore, chi va dicendo all'anima, sospira. The first symptom of returning life was a quivering about the lips, a little mute soundless attempt at speech, but the eyes were still closed, and the quivering sank into stillness. Then, feebly leaning on her arms for an instant to steady herself, Margaret gathered herself up and rose. Her comb had fallen out of her hair, and with an intuitive desire to efface the traces of weakness and bring herself into order again, she sought for it, although from time to time, in the course of the search, she had to sit down and recover strength. Her head drooped forwards, her hands meekly laid one upon the other. She tried to recall the force of her temptation by endeavouring to remember the details which had thrown her into such deadly fright. But she could not. She only understood two facts, that Frederick had been in danger of being pursued and detected in London as not only guilty of manslaughter, but as the more unpardonable leader of the mutiny, and that she had lied to save him. There was one comfort. Her lie had saved him, if only by gaining some additional time. If the inspector came again tomorrow, after she had received the letter she longed for to assure her of her brother's safety, she would brave shame and stand in her bitter penance. She, the lofty Margaret, acknowledging before a crowded justice room, if need were, that she had been as a dog and done this thing. But if he came before she heard from Frederick, if he returned, as he had half-threatened in a few hours, why, she would tell that lie again, though how the words would come out, after all this terrible pause for reflection and self-reproach, without betraying her falsehood, she did not know, she could not tell. But her repetition of it would gain time, time for Frederick. She was roused by Dixon's entrance into the room. She had just been letting out Mr. Thornton. He had hardly gone 10 steps in the street before a passing omnibus stopped close by him, and a man got down and came up to him, touching his hat as he did so. It was the police inspector. Mr. Thornton had obtained for him his first situation in the police and had heard from time to time of the progress of his protégé, but they had not often met, and at first Mr. Thornton did not remember him. "My name is Watson, George Watson, sir, that you got—"
"Ah, yes, I recollect. Why, you are getting on famously, I hear."
"Yes, sir, I ought to thank you, sir, but it is on a little matter of business I made so bold as to speak to you now. I believe you were the magistrate who attempted to take down the deposition of a poor man who died in the infirmary last night."
"Yes," replied Mr. Thornton. "I went and heard some kind of a rambling statement, which the clerk said was of no great use. I'm afraid he was but a drunken fellow, though there is no doubt he came to his death by violence at last. One of my mother's servants was engaged to him, I believe, and she is in great distress today. What about him?"
"Why, sir, his death is oddly mixed up with somebody in the house I saw you coming out of just now. It was a Mr. Hales, I believe."
"Yes," said Mr. Thornton, turning sharp round and looking into the inspector's face with sudden interest. "What about it?"
"Why, sir, it seems to me that I've got a pretty distinct chain of evidence, inculpating a gentleman who was walking with Miss Hale that night at the Outwood station, as the man who struck or pushed Leonard's off the platform and so caused his death. But the young lady denies that she was there at the time."
"Miss Hale denies she was there,"
repeated Mr. Thornton in an altered voice. "Tell me, what evening was it? What time?"
"About 6 o'clock on the evening of Thursday the 26th.
They walked on side by side in silence for a minute or two. The inspector was the first to speak.
"You see, sir, there is like to be a coroner's inquest, and I've got a young man who is pretty positive, at least he was at first, since he has heard of the young lady's denial. He says he should not like to swear, but still he's pretty positive that he saw Miss Hale at the station, walking about with a gentleman not 5 minutes before the time when one of the porters saw a scuffle, which he set down to some of Leonard's impudence, but which led to the fall which caused his death. And seeing you come out of the very house, sir, I thought I might make bold to ask if—" "You see, it's always awkward having to do with cases of disputed identity, and one doesn't like to doubt the word of a respectable young woman unless one has strong proof to the contrary." "And she denied having been at the station that evening,"
repeated Mr. Thornton in a low, brooding tone.
"Yes, sir, twice over, as distinct as could be. I told her I should call again, but seeing you just as I was on my way back from questioning the young man who said it was her, I thought I would ask your advice, both as the magistrate who saw Leonard's on his deathbed and as the gentleman who got me my berth in the force."
"You were quite right," said Mr. Thornton. "Don't take any steps till you have seen me again." "The young lady will expect me to call, from what I said."
"I only want to delay you an hour. It's now 3. Come to my warehouse at 4.
"Very well, sir." And they parted company. Mr. Thornton hurried to his warehouse, and sternly forbidding his clerks to allow anyone to interrupt him, he went his way to his own private room and locked the door. Then he indulged himself in the torture of thinking it all over and realizing every detail. How could he have lulled himself into the unsuspicious calm in which her tearful image had mirrored itself not 2 hours before, till he had weakly pitied her and yearned towards her and forgotten the savage distrustful jealousy with which the sight of her, and that unknown to him, at such an hour, in such a place, had inspired him? How could one so pure have stooped from her decorous and noble manner of bearing? But was it decorous? Was it? He hated himself for the idea that forced itself upon him, just for an instant, no more. And yet, while it was present, thrilled him with its old potency of attraction towards her image. And then this falsehood. How terrible must be some dread of shame to be revealed. For, after all, the provocation given by such a man as Leonard's was, when excited by drinking, might, in all probability, be more than enough to justify anyone who came forward to state the circumstances openly and without reserve. How creeping and deadly that fear which could bow down the truthful Margaret to falsehood. He could almost pity her. What would be the end of it? She could not have considered all she was entering upon. If there was an inquest and the young man came forward, suddenly he started up. There should be no inquest. He would save Margaret. He would take the responsibility of preventing the inquest, the issue of which, from the uncertainty of the medical testimony, which he had vaguely heard the night before from the surgeon in attendance, could be but doubtful. The doctors had discovered an internal disease far advanced and sure to prove fatal. They had stated that death might have been accelerated by the fall or by the subsequent drinking and exposure to cold. If he had but known how Margaret would have become involved in the affair, if he had but foreseen that she would have stained her whiteness by a falsehood, he could have saved her by a word. For the question of inquest or no inquest had hung trembling in the balance only the night before. Miss Hale might love another, was indifferent and contemptuous to him, but he would yet do her faithful acts of service, of which she should never know. He might despise her, but the woman whom he had once loved should be kept from shame. And shame it would be to pledge herself to a lie in a public court, or otherwise to stand and acknowledge her reason for desiring darkness rather than light. Very grey and stern did Mr. Thornton look as he passed out through his wandering clerks. He was away about half an hour, and scarcely less stern did he look when he returned, although his errand had been successful. He wrote two lines on a slip of paper, put it in an envelope and sealed it up. This he gave to one of the clerks, saying, "I appointed Watson, he who was a packer in the warehouse, and who went into the police, to call on me at 4 o'clock. I have just met with a gentleman from Liverpool, who wishes to see me before he leaves town. Take care to give this note to Watson, he calls." The note contained these words: "There will be no inquest. Medical evidence not sufficient to justify it. Take no further steps. I have not seen the coroner, but I will take the responsibility." Well, thought Watson, it relieves me from an awkward job. None of my witnesses seemed certain of anything except the young woman. She was clear and distinct enough. The porter at the railroad had seen a scuffle, or when he found it was likely to bring him in as a witness, when it might not have been a scuffle, only a little larking, and Leonard's might have jumped off the platform himself. He would not stick firm to anything. And Jennings, the grocer's shopman, well, he was not quite so bad, but I doubt if I could have got him up to an oath after he heard that Miss Hale flatly denied it. It would have been a troublesome job and no satisfaction, and now I must go and tell them they won't be wanted. He accordingly presented himself again at Mr. Hale's that evening. Her father and Dixon would fain have persuaded Margaret to go to bed, but they, neither of them, knew the reason for her low, continued refusals to do so. Dixon had learned part of the truth, but only part. Margaret would not tell any human being of what she had said, and she did not reveal the fatal termination to Leonard's fall from the platform. So Dixon, curiosity combined with her allegiance to urge Margaret to go to rest, which her appearance, as she lay on the sofa, showed but too clearly that she required. She did not speak except when spoken to. She tried to smile back in reply to her father's anxious looks and words of tender inquiry, but instead of a smile, the wan lips resolved themselves into a sigh. He was so miserably uneasy, but at last she consented to go into her own room and prepare for going to bed. She was indeed inclined to give up the idea that the inspector would call again that night, as it was already past 9 o'clock. She stood by her father, holding on to the back of his chair. "You will go to bed soon, Papa, won't you? Don't sit up alone."
What his answer was, she did not hear.
The words were lost in the far smaller point of sound that magnified itself to her fears and filled her brain. There was a low ring at the doorbell. She kissed her father and glided downstairs, with the rapidity of motion of which no one would have thought her capable, who had seen her the minute before. She put aside Dixon.
"Don't come. I will open the door. I know it is him. I must manage it all myself."
"As you please, miss," said Dixon testily,
but in a moment afterward she added, "But you're not fit for it. You are more dead than alive."
"Am I?" said Margaret, turning round and showing her eyes all aglow with strange fire, her cheeks flushed, though her lips were baked and livid still.
She opened the door to the inspector and preceded him into the study. She placed the candle on the table and snuffed it carefully before she turned round and faced him.
"You are late," said she.
"Well?"
She held her breath for the answer.
"I'm sorry to have given any unnecessary trouble, ma'am, for after all, they've given up all thoughts of holding an inquest. I have had other work to do and other people to see, or I should have been here before now."
"Then it is ended," said Margaret. "There is to be no further inquiry."
"I believe I've got Mr. Thornton's note about me," said the inspector, fumbling in his pocketbook.
"Mr. Thornton's?" said Margaret.
"Yes, he's a magistrate. Ah, here it is."
She could not see to read it. No, not although she was close to the candle. The words swam before her, but she held it in her hand and looked at it as if she were intently studying it.
"I'm sure, ma'am, it's a great weight off my mind, for the evidence was so uncertain, you see, that the man had received any blow at all, and if any question of identity came in, it so complicated the case, as I told Mr. Thornton."
"Mr. Thornton," said Margaret again,
"I met him this morning, just as he was coming out of this house, and as he's an old friend of mine, besides being the magistrate who saw Leonard's last night, I made bold to tell him of my difficulty."
Margaret sighed deeply. She did not want to hear any more. She was afraid alike of what she had heard and of what she might hear. She wished that the man would go. She forced herself to speak.
"Thank you for calling. It is very late. I dare say it is past 10 o'clock. Oh, here is the note," she continued, suddenly interpreting the meaning of the hand held out to receive it.
He was putting it up when she said,
"I think it is a cramped, dazzling sort of writing. I could not read it. Will you just read it to me?"
He read it aloud to her.
"Thank you. You told Mr. Thornton that I was not there."
"Oh, of course, ma'am. I'm sorry now that I acted upon information, which seems to have been so erroneous. At first the young man was so positive, and now he says that he doubted all along, and hopes that his mistake won't have occasioned you such annoyance as to lose their shop your custom. Good night, ma'am."
"Good night."
She rang the bell for Dixon to show him out. As Dixon returned up the passage, Margaret passed her swiftly.
"It is all right," said she, without looking at Dixon.
And before the woman could follow her with further questions, she had sped upstairs and entered her bedchamber and bolted her door. She threw herself, dressed as she was, upon her bed. She was too much exhausted to think. Half an hour or more elapsed before the cramped nature of her position and the chilliness, supervening upon great fatigue, had the power to rouse her numbed faculties. Then she began to recall, to combine, to wonder. The first idea that presented itself to her was that all this sickening alarm on Frederick's behalf was over, that the strain was past. The next was a wish to remember every word of the inspector's which related to Mr. Thornton. When had he seen him? What had he said? What had Mr. Thornton done? What were the exact words of his note? And until she could recollect, even to the placing or omitting an article, the very expressions which he had used in the note, her mind refused to go on with its progress. But the next conviction she came to was clear enough. Mr. Thornton had seen her close to Outwood Station on the fatal Thursday night, and had been told of her denial that she was there. She stood as a liar in his eyes. She was a liar.
but she had no thought of penitence before God. Nothing but chaos and night surrounded the one lurid fact that in Mr. Thornton's eyes she was degraded. She cared not to think, even to herself, of how much of excuse she might plead. That had nothing to do with Mr. Thornton. She never dreamed that he, or anyone else, could find cause for suspicion in what was so natural as her accompanying her brother. But what was really false and wrong was known to him, and he had a right to judge her.
"Oh, Frederick, Frederick," she cried, "what have I not sacrificed for you?"
Even when she fell asleep, her thoughts were compelled to travel the same circle, only with exaggerated and monstrous circumstances of pain. When she awoke, a new idea flashed upon her with all the brightness of the morning. Mr. Thornton had learnt her falsehood before he went to the coroner. That suggested the thought that he had possibly been influenced so to do with a view of sparing her the repetition of her denial. But she pushed this notion on one side with the sick willfulness of a child. If it were so, she felt no gratitude to him, as it only showed her how keenly he must have seen that she was disgraced already, before he took such unwonted pains to spare her any further trial of truthfulness, which had already failed so signally. She would have gone through the whole. She would have perjured herself to save Frederick, rather, far rather, than Mr. Thornton should have had the knowledge that prompted him to interfere to save her. What ill fate brought him in contact with the inspector? What made him be the very magistrate sent for to receive Leonard's deposition? What had Leonard said? How much of it was intelligible to Mr. Thornton, who might already, for aught she knew, be aware of the old accusation against Frederick, through their mutual friend Mr. Bell? If so, he had striven to save the son, who came in defiance of the law to attend his mother's deathbed. And under this idea she could feel grateful. Not yet, if ever she should, if his interference had been prompted by contempt. Oh, had anyone such just cause to feel contempt for her? Mr. Thornton, above all people, on whom she had looked down from her imaginary heights till now. She suddenly found herself at his feet and was strangely distressed at her fall. She shrank from following out the premises to their conclusion, and so acknowledging to herself how much she valued his respect and good opinion. Whenever this idea presented itself to her at the end of a long avenue of thoughts, she turned away from following that path. She would not believe in it. It was later than she fancied, for in the agitation of the previous night she had forgotten to wind up her watch, and Mr. Hale had given her special orders that she was not to be disturbed by the usual awakening. By and by, the door opened cautiously, and Dixon put her head in. Perceiving that Margaret was awake, she came forwards with a letter. "Here's something to do you good, miss. A letter from Master Frederick."
"Thank you, Dixon. How late it is."
She spoke very languidly, and suffered Dixon to lay it on the counterpane before her, without putting out a hand to take it. "You want your breakfast, I'm sure. I will bring it you in a minute. Master has got the tray already, I know." Margaret did not reply. She let her go. She felt that she must be alone before she could open that letter. She opened it at last. The first thing that caught her eye was the date 2 days earlier than she received it. He had then written when he had promised, and their alarm might have been spared. But she would read the letter and see. It was hasty enough, but perfectly satisfactory. He had seen Henry Lennox, who knew enough of the case to shake his head over it in the first instance, and tell him he had done a very daring thing in returning to England, with such an accusation, backed by such powerful influence, hanging over him. But when they had come to talk it over, Mr. Lennox had acknowledged that there might be some chance of his acquittal, if he could but prove his statements by credible witnesses. That in such case it might be worthwhile to stand his trial, otherwise it would be a great risk. He would examine, he would take every pains. "It struck me," said Frederick, "that your introduction, little sister of mine, went a long way. Is it so?" "He made many inquiries, I can assure you.
He seemed a sharp, intelligent fellow, and in good practice, too, to judge from the signs of business and the number of clerks about him. But these may be only lawyer's dodges. I have just caught a packet on the point of sailing. I am off in 5 minutes. I may have to come back to England again on this business, so keep my visit secret. I shall send my father some rare old sherry, such as you cannot buy in England. Such stuff as I've got in the bottle before me. He needs something of the kind. My dear love to him. God bless him. I'm sure. Here's my cab. P.S. What an escape that was. Take care you don't breathe of my having been, not even to the shores. Margaret turned to the envelope. It was marked too late. The letter had probably been trusted to some careless waiter who had forgotten to post it. Oh, what slight cobwebs of chances stand between us and temptation. Frederick had been safe and out of England 20, nay 30 hours ago, and it was only about 17 hours since she had told a falsehood to baffle pursuit, which even then would have been vain. How faithless she had been! Where now was her proud motto, Fais ce que doit advienne que pourra? If she had but dared to bravely tell the truth as regarded herself, defying them to find out what she refused to tell concerning another, how light of heart she would now have felt, not humbled before God as having failed in trust towards him, not degraded and abased in Mr. Thornton's sight. She caught herself up in this with a miserable tremor. Here was she, classing his low opinion of her, alongside with the displeasure of God. How was it that he haunted her imagination so persistently? What could it be? Why did she care for what he thought, in spite of all her pride, in spite of herself? She believed that she could have borne the sensible, mighty displeasure because he knew all and could read her penitence and hear her cries for help in time to come. But Mr. Thornton, why did she tremble and hide her face in the pillow? What strong feeling had overtaken her at last? She sprang out of bed and prayed long and earnestly. It soothed and comforted her so to open her heart. But as soon as she reviewed her position, she found the sting was still there, that she was not good enough nor pure enough to be indifferent to the lowered opinion of a fellow creature, that the thought of how he must be looking upon her with contempt stood between her and her sense of wrongdoing. She took her letter in to her father as soon as she was dressed. There was so slight an allusion to their alarm at the railroad station that Mr. Hale passed over it without paying any attention to it. Indeed, beyond the mere fact of Frederick having sailed undiscovered and unsuspected, he did not gather much from the letter at the time. He was so uneasy about Margaret's pallid looks. She seemed continually on the point of weeping. "You are sadly overdone, Margaret. It is no wonder. But you must let me nurse you now." He made her lie down on the sofa and went for a shawl to cover her with. His tenderness released her tears, and she cried bitterly. Poor child, said he, looking fondly at her, as she lay with her face to the wall, shaking with her sobs. After a while they ceased, and she began to wonder whether she durst give herself the relief of telling her father of all her trouble. But there were more reasons against it than for it. The only one for it was the relief to herself, and against it was the thought that it would add materially to her father's nervousness if it were indeed necessary for Frederick to come to England again, that he would dwell on the circumstance of his son's having caused the death of a man, however unwittingly and unwillingly, that this knowledge would perpetually recur to trouble him in various shapes of exaggeration and distortion from the simple truth. And about her own great fault, he would be distressed beyond measure at her want of courage and faith, yet perpetually troubled to make excuses for her. Formerly Margaret would have come to him as priest as well as father, to tell him of her temptation and her sin. But latterly they had not spoken much on such subjects, and she knew not how, in his change of opinions, he would reply if the depth of her soul called unto his. No, she would keep her secret and bear the burden alone. Alone she would go before God and cry for his absolution. Alone she would endure her disgraced position in the opinion of Mr. Thornton. She was unspeakably touched by the tender efforts of her father to think of cheerful subjects on which to talk, and so to take her thoughts away from dwelling on all that had happened of late. It was some months since he had been so talkative as he was this day. He would not let her sit